From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's what we'll try to do on Radio West today. Give a brief history of everyone who ever lived. It's actually the title of the science writer Adam Rutherford's new book. It describes the history of humankind going back hundreds of thousands of years, and it uses as the source genetics. One of the things we talk about is how all humans are remarkably close relatives and that race doesn't exist. We'll be right back. We have a new short doc at Radio West Films you should go check out. It comes from San Juan County, where it's tough to keep teachers at the Native American schools there. The tribes in the region may have figured out a solution because consistency matters to these kids. And once a student gives a teacher their trust, they want to know if you'll be back next year. Go see it at radiowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's something fascinating about those mail-order genetics testing companies. You know, the ones where you spin in a tube and you ship off your DNA to be analyzed. What's cool about it is that it tells a story. It makes us feel more interesting and exotic than we probably are because our ancestors lived all over the place. They did courageous things and cowardly things. They were royalty, maybe criminals. This is the exciting state of technology. As the science writer Adam Rutherford says in his new book, geneticists have suddenly become historians. Rutherford says the study of ancient humans, for example, used to be limited to old teeth and bones, but now with genetics, we can piece together a much more complicated picture of their lives. Rutherford's book is about how genetics is helping us understand our past, but it's also about who we are today, what DNA tells us about our families, and the idea of race. The book is called A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived. Rutherford is a geneticist, a science writer, a broadcaster. He's hosted BBC radio and television programs and writes also for The Guardian. He joined us recently from the studios of the BBC in London. Usually, we describe our history as being like a tree. But Rutherford says, really, it's more like a shrub. The fact is, our past as humans is muddled.
We sort of think about our family trees in a very nice diagrammatic way. You know, when we draw our family trees, there's you and two parents and four grandparents and so on, and they sort of get interesting and you build these trees because everyone has had two parents. But I think they have given us the impression that this is how family trees work throughout the entirety of human history, and therefore the entirety of biological history, which is, you know, 4 billion years. And the truth is that that's just not the case for two simple facts. The first is that there are more people alive than at any point in history today. And the second point is that the number of ancestors that you have is it actually doubles as you go back through time. Now, that seems like they should be in opposition to each other. You know, in one direction, the number is getting larger, and in the same direction, the number should be getting smaller. But the truth is that what it means is that our family trees sort of collapse in on each other after a few generations, and individuals might occupy multiple positions on your family tree as you go back through time. Eventually, you get to a point where everyone alive at a specific time in history is actually the ancestor of not just you, but actually everyone alive today.
Right.
And we call that the ISA point. So all family trees become matted after a certain amount of time. And then a bit further back, they become fully, totally enmeshed, meaning that everyone alive at one time is the ancestor of everyone alive today. And the amazing thing is that when you do the maths on this, and now that we've, in the last couple of years, we do the genetics on it too, if you take Europe, the ISA point is only the 10th century, right? So 1,000 years ago, everyone alive in Europe are the ancestors of everyone alive today.
It's interesting how we misread our genetic history. And you say in the book that humans love to tell stories. In fact, you say that our species seems to crave a narrative, but not only that, narrative satisfaction. And I wanted you to talk about that because this seems to explain why we are misreading all of this. I guess it's like we want to tidy things up too much.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's a very natural characteristic of humans to do, well, two things. Not, like you said, to tidy up stories so that they have beginnings, middles, and ends, and, you know, everyone's individual story, they are the end point, and their story continues with children or other members of the family. The other thing that we do is we're very, very prone to categorizing things, to trying to fit things into neat boxes. And nature's really bad at that. And so, you know, species definitions tend to be really blurry at the edges. And so if you combine those two things, you know, our natural desire to tell, to have narratives in our lives, it is slightly in conflict with, well, both actually what happens in evolutionary history, which is that it's messy and tangled, like we were just talking about, but also it's not quite the way how science works either, yeah. Because science only ever tends towards the truth. So it leans in towards the truth permanently. And we refine our theories so they become more true, but we never actually meet them. And so, you know, it's a constantly moving target. The more research we do, the more doors we open, the more we find out. And so I guess in some sense, one of the reasons the way I say it in the book is that we're culturally predisposed to misunderstand genetics and genealogy in our own family trees is for that exact reason, that we want narrative satisfaction, and science and reality will not give it to us. And so there's, you know, the tension there. The reason people like me will always be employed is because there is always going to be that tension between what we want and what is true.
But what has all this meant to, I guess, our self-perception as humans, you know, our concept of race, which we'll get to, or even class for that matter, because it must blow more than a few minds that, as you say, nobody's from the past or being elevated to some of the most important people who ever lived when we really look deep and down on this. I mean, this really seems to attack self-perception and our concept of kind of who we are.
I think it does and it doesn't. So it does in the sense that if your identity, which is both personal and at various group levels, you know, whether it's your immediate family or your state or your country or the football team you support or, you know, your class at school, all of those different levels of identity exist and they are real, and it is not right for anyone other than someone within that group to define those identities. The problem is that biology has been used historically, and I argue in the book it is being used more now because of the sort of newfound prevalence of genetic testing and commercial genetic testing, that it's being used nowadays, biology is being used in order to set these boundaries for identities at various levels. Now, that is folly in many cases. It's just nonsense, and scientific nonsense for in some examples. And then, you know, then there's the really sort of pernicious end of the scale, which is that you have white supremacists who are declaring, you know, racial purity, and now that can be verified using genetics, which it can't. And so what has happened is that the emergence of genetics as a sort of a service available to everyone, which has only really happened in the last 5 years, is being used, well, misused often, in order to sort of suggest identities, tribal identities, race identities. And it's just not good science. It's not verifiable scientifically. So, you know, it's the balance between what is people's individual identities, which are set up culturally by themselves or by the groups that they're within, compared to any form of sort of biological self. Those two things are they're largely mismatched.
Yeah, it's that big gap you describe in the book about what science actually says about all of this, and yet how we talk about and how we understand all of this, I guess. So there's a big gap.
Yeah, it
there.
Is. And there's a deep sort of cultural history of this as well. I'm not blaming anyone for this. This is how we work. This is how not just the history of science, not just the history of genetics, which is only really 100 years old, but we have been talking about inheritance and talking about families and sex and how things are passed down within families for the entirety of human history. And so these are really important cultural identifiers which are rooted in biology. The problem is that in the last 10, 20 years, but more than that in the last 5 years, genetics has revealed, the science of genetics, the science of studying DNA and DNA variants between people and between populations, doesn't serve to reinforce what the way we think about our cultural identities.
Yeah.
So, you know, you mentioned race then. It's within the genetics community, it is a non-controversial thing to say race isn't really a scientific concept. It doesn't really exist as a valid scientific idea.
Right.
One of the reasons, one of the motivations for writing this book at this time was because I'm a geneticist. I spend my life talking about genetics in public. And I found this huge disconnect between what I could say to colleagues in the lab, which where they'd nod in agreement, or we'd have a scientific discussion about it, and then you'd say something in public about race and genetics, and people would frown at you or say, "Is that right?" So I felt that there was a really big gap between what we know and what we talk about within genetics and the overall public discourse. So, you know, trying to bridge that gap is something that I guess that's my career, really.
Yeah. I guess this is as good a time as any to get to this question of these ancestry DNA tests that have become such the thing lately. You sound pretty skeptical. I mean, I think you called this type genetic astrology in some ways, that is that fair to say? I mean, you're pretty skeptical about it.
I am pretty skeptical. That phrase genetic astrology, not actually my phrase, but I do repeat it. That was coined by some colleagues of mine at UCL here in London. And it was really specifically referring to a few companies whose interpretations of the DNA that customers pay to supply is, you know, pretty absurd.
Yeah.
Sort of ahistorical as well as being ascientific.
Well, they're trying they're trying to fit that tidy narrative, it seems like.
Well, yeah, really. I mean, really, but also just appealing to a very low bar of interesting narratives. So, you know, there was this one company which has now gone bust, who sort of just make up these stories. So, you know, they take a bit, you pay, you spit in the tube, you send it off, and then you get this little profile back of a fictional character from you know, 10th century Europe, who is supposedly your ancestor.
Right.
And they were nuts.
Yeah.
I mean, they were crazy. They were like, you know, I've got friends whose profiles came back saying that you are descended directly from the people who invented porridge. my own profile came back from a group of wandering Germanic folk who skidded across the frozen Rhine in the 7th century. Now, we've already said in this conversation why that's nonsense.
Yeah.
Because if you go to the 7th century in Europe, You're well past this point where everyone is descended from everyone. So if I'm descended from the guys, the Germanic tribe skidding across the Rhine in the 7th century, then literally every European is. That sounds like an Italian surname you've got there.
That's so right. Yes, yes.
You're the same. You're descended from those skidding guys too.
Yes, yes. You say in the book, and this seems like an important theme, that just as important as what genetics can tell us is what it can't. What does genetics actually tell us about our relatives? Because you say we have far less in common with our ancestors than we think, which gets back to what you were just sort of mentioning there. But talk a little bit about the limits of all of this, because that's an important theme in the book, it seems.
Yeah, it is. It's you know, when we think about the DNA that we carry, and, you know, you have half of your DNA from your mother and half of your DNA from your father. And that means that we can measure with, you know, really, really intensely good accuracy immediate familial relationships.
Yeah.
And that's particularly important these days for forensics, which has been around since the 80s. And also something which is happening more and more now, which is re-identification of the parents of adopted children. Mm. And that's really important and really robust, really decent science. At the other end of the scale, DNA and genomes can tell us so much about our species and the migration of our species across the planet over geological time periods, you know, so through prehistory. You know, one of the great stories that I focus on in the first chapter is how we have now identified the full genome of several Neanderthal people from between 50 and, a couple of hundred thousand years now. And, you know, the stories within there show very clearly what these people were like, and they were very similar to us. In fact, they were similar enough to us that we repeatedly and successfully had sexual relations with them, and both me and you, as people of European descent, carry Neanderthal DNA within us. Mm. So at that sense, you know, you've got DNA is really good for immediate family, and it's really good for sort of species-level huge migrations of populations across the world. It's less informative in the sort of middle ground of history to show relatedness between individuals within a sort of medium scale. And the reason for that is, again, the same thing we were talking about how interrelated we are. Mm. The chances are that me and you, having never spoken before, certainly having never met, being born in different countries, we're probably fourth or fifth cousins, right? We probably have shared ancestry no less than 200 or 300 years ago. Now, that means that we have more shared DNA with each other than we do probably with someone from, I don't know, China or an Aboriginal Australian or someone from a tribe in Tierra del Fuego, something like that.
Yeah.
So that level of relatedness, the DNA within that is only partially informative because, you know, there are literally millions, if not billions of people who are fifth, sixth, third cousins. I think everyone on Earth is something like a 20th cousin. So it's that middle ground. And that's the bit of history as well that people are most interested in, because I get 10 emails a week from people telling me that they're descended from Vikings.
Yeah.
Good for you, man. Everyone in Europe is descended from Vikings.
Yeah.
I am more polite than that when I respond.
Right. We should also say that you mentioned that life on Earth has been on this kind of continuum, but we have to be careful to say that we've made quote-unquote evolutionary progress. That's not really how it works. And this seems to be one of those ideas that really bothers you, the idea that we're somehow moving towards some destiny.
Yeah, it is. It's a tricky one to get the wording right on this, because evolution doesn't work in a direction.
Yeah.
So the idea that there is progress towards, well, being upright and hairless and having big brains and really sophisticated communication skills so that we can talk, you know, 5,000 miles apart from each other at quite a high level. That is the path that has been carved out for us by evolution and by the evolution of our sociality and culture. But it's kind of wrong to say that we're more evolved than anything else. We're you know, everything is on the same tree of life. So a bacteria that has a pathway that also lasts 4 billion years is just as evolved as humans are. So it's just that notion of progress.
Yeah.
Again, it's another sort of cultural idea, which if you don't think about it too hard, pushes us in the direction of, well, you know, categorizing us as very special. Now, this is a bit of a problem for me, because I'm not misanthropic about this. I think humans are amazing. I think, you know, we are an astonishing species, and the things that we have done are brilliant. I think of the, you know, the moon landings or eradicating smallpox from Earth. These are achievements which are worth celebrating. But at the same time, we are animals.
Yep.
And we are evolved using the same processes as a zebra or a bacteria or a blue whale or anything like that. And so, you know, the question of human exceptionalism is one that is a pathway that we have to tread quite lightly on.
Yeah. Then how do you explain just basically why it is that our brand of primitive primate became so successful? Because, I mean, one of the, you mentioned the Neanderthals. I mean, and as you say in the book, they had this reputation for being these, you know, grunting oafs and brutish cavemen. But you say there's really nothing in their history that shows they were actually stupid. So what is genetics telling us about them, and why is it that they disappeared and we didn't? What can we say that we know about that at this point?
Well, that is the great unanswered question you're asking me there. And we do have clues. You're right. You're right. They don't. There's nothing in either genetics or the morphology, so, you know, the shapes of their bodies, that indicates that they were significantly different from us in any sort of behavioral terms. They did look a bit different from us, but not that different.
Yeah.
You know, they had sort of clunkier brows, so more ridged brows on their heads, slightly flatter faces, tended to be a bit stockier, slightly more barrel-chested. But if you tidied a Neanderthal up and stuck him on the subway, you might glance at them and think they look a bit odd, or, you know, maybe they should go and play in the NFL. But they were humans, and they were people, and they had culture, and they mourned their dead, and they created sophisticated tools. They had tattooing kits. We now know, and this has only been published in the last month or so, that the earliest art that we're aware of, which dates from about 70,000 years ago in Spain, in some caves on the Spanish coast in Cantabria, was Neanderthal and not Homo sapiens. So when it comes to some of the sort of cultural benchmarks of what we consider to be, you know, the hallmarks of modernity, of us, the behaviours that are recognisable as the things that we do today, it's quite clear that Neanderthals had, if not the full sets, but many of the things that we consider to be modern. So the question you were asking a minute ago, why did they die out and us not? Neanderthals were spread over a large area of Europe and into Eurasia, and the more we look, the more we find. But they were primarily a sort of European population. But we also think from the genetics that there weren't very many of them. And this isn't uncontroversial, but it looks like they existed in small groups and had low levels of genetic diversity. Now, in general, lower levels of genetic diversity are less good for the survival of an organism, of a species, than high levels. Now, I'm sort of in semi-speculation area here because we don't really know, but we definitely outbred them. We see more genetic diversity in larger populations than in Homo sapiens than we do from the Neanderthals. And I think it's a reasonable supposition that is one of the contributory factors to their demise and our survival. But, you know, that narrative satisfaction thing that we were talking about earlier, people want to know, what is the one thing? What was it? Did we hunt them? Did we eat them? Did we have sex with them? Well, maybe all of the above. Yeah. All we know for sure is that we're here and they're not, but that we carry some of their genes inside of us. So their legacy, the way I describe it in the book, their legacy will last as long as us.
That's Adam Rutherford. His book is called A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, The Human Story Retold Through Our Genes. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West, and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the geneticist and science writer Adam Rutherford about his new book, which describes the history of humankind going back hundreds of thousands of years. And he uses as his source text DNA, or genetics. The book is called A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived. There are various chapters in the book where you explore what we know about different groups of people in different places. And I wanted to focus on the Americas at this point. How do we account for so many different languages and cultures of, you know, so-called indigenous people, Native Americans, I guess we can say, because there was some belief that, you know, there were these different waves, and that there's some idea that just people with particular technology spread from the north to the south, but that apparently that's not how it worked. And I'm just wondering what we know about that.
Yeah, it's a great question. The chapter in the version of the book that you've got doesn't exist in the original. When it was published in the US, my US publishers, they asked for a new chapter on the Americas, and it was a joy to write that. Part of it was trying to establish what the current scientific thinking is about how the Americas were populated, because there have been many ideas over, you know, recent history, over scientific history, and I think we're getting to the stage where we've got a pretty robust model.
Yeah.
And that is that Alaska was connected to Siberia in Russia by what we refer to as a land bridge, but actually, you know, it's 5,000 miles across, so it was right. just continuous land.
Yeah.
And that was that during the last ice ages, the sea level's much lower, which means that's where the land, that's why the land was raised. And at the end of the ice age, the ice melts, the sea levels rise, and America, what is now Alaska, gets separated from Russia. But before that, there was the migration of a people, a founding population, the first peoples of the Americas. Some of the details are still being ironed out, but now the best fit, which is based on archaeology and now genetic data, is that there was this population that were probably isolated in what is now Alaska and northern Canada for many thousands of years. Now we can tell that because we can look at the patterns of the genes within populations that have spread out through the Americas as a result. And what you see is a sort of a slightly restricted gene pool with only a few of a particular type of DNA, mitochondrial DNA, and all of the indigenous peoples of the Americas, including South America and Mesoamerica, have a sort of smaller set of a smaller genetic diversity. It has no impact on their health or their behavior or anything like that. It's just something that we can measure that is useful for understanding this pattern. And so then the question becomes, how and when did this founding population sort of filter, percolate down through from what is now Canada right down to the bottom of South America?
Yeah.
And we've got models for that. Some people, I think it's a good idea, think that the people were bouncing down the coast because coastal climates tend to be more consistent. It's also, you know, you're not impeded by mountains necessarily. Coast is always a good place for lots of food. Mm. So, you know, foraging things like mussels and crustaceans, but also fishing, because there's plenty of fishing technology for these people. And also the inland routes may well have been blocked by glaciers and by mountains. But generally, we've got this picture that, you know, by 10,000 years ago, there are people in Central America and South America.
Yeah.
This is live research. This is, you know, this is research which is ongoing at the moment and trying to piece together exactly how those patterns worked. In terms of the diversity of the people, languages is not something I have any great knowledge or expertise on. But what we do see is sort of fragmentations, smaller populations that migrate and occupy different places. This is, of course, over thousands of years. So we can only really identify these differences using genetics, because over that time period, everyone is related to everyone.
Yeah, I was so interested in how the complicated relationship between so-called Native Americans and European occupiers or colonizers has really complicated how we talk about and how we understand the way the Americas were peopled. I mean, you talk about, for example, how Europeans, they're fairly comfortable with this idea of migration, of, you know, people spreading out, you know, fighting and conquering and occupying. But Native Americans here are pretty sensitive about this, and you can see how they would be. And so this idea of being in one place is really a part of their identity. Talk a little bit about that, because this was an interesting part of this section.
Yeah, it was fascinating to research this. I have to be really cautious about expressing the views of indigenous people that I have no real knowledge of. This is just from talking to people and reading, reading their works. But part of the argument that has been proposed by researchers and by myself is that within the Judeo-Christian tradition, as you say, migration is part of our story. It is part of the route from Israel out of being expelled into Egypt and just migrating around, and that's the very Judeo-Christian version. Outside of that, we've then got, you know, I'm British. Mm. We are an island nation, and we've been invaded countless times. Not significantly since 1066, but before that, there are Vikings and there are Angles and Saxes and Romans and the Celts and the Picts. And, you know, this constant movement, this constant traffic of people in and around Europe, across the Mediterranean, into Africa, the rise of the Greek Empire, the Roman Empire, the collapse of the Roman Empire, and so on.
all of these things, and the fact that we have the silk routes, which span the whole of Asia, and you see the, you know, cultural transmission right the way from China all the way through to Greece and beyond over thousands of years. These are the sort of defining characteristics of this part of the world for thousands of years. As I understand it, the many Native American peoples, their narratives, their creation myths are very, very heavily tied to the land. Yeah. They are, you know, part of the land that they live in. And so various tribes believe that they were created in the land that they currently occupy. Now, that they are... They're stories, they're creation myths. Science doesn't really verify them, which is fine. We must be respectful of what people wish to believe, and I've got no issue with that whatsoever. The clumsiness, I think the issue really arises, or one of the many issues, you know, bearing in mind this is all stacked on top of 500 years of European colonization anyway,
yeah, right,
and some pretty heinous treatment of indigenous people throughout the Americas. A slightly clumsy approach by modern scientists, including anthropologists and geneticists, is turning up and saying, hey, you indigenous people, we now have the scientific tools to actually tell you where you came from, where your people came from. And we can do that because we've got these tools. We've got this science now. All you need to do is give us a blood sample or spit in a tube, and we will sort out your creation myth and tell you what's true or not. Now, I'm sort of slightly playing up the scenario there, but I think there have been some really, really clumsy, you know, sort of poorly executed projects which may have had good intentions to understand the peopling of the Americas or to understand the peopling of everyone in the world, proper scientific questions behind them. But they've been done with a sort of colonial mindset, which is, hey, we know how to do this and we're going to help you guys. That sort of patronizing attitude has resulted in measurable animosity between sort of Western science and a very rich, deep, long-standing culture. Now, I think in America, particularly in Northern America and in the USA and Canada, there have been some specific examples where these have been problematic, to the extent that a couple of years ago, leaders that represent many tribes across the Americas basically issued statements saying, don't talk to these guys, don't talk to geneticists, because they are going to screw you over.
Yeah.
And this, you know, that's a terrible state of affairs to be in. We've ended up in a relationship with indigenous peoples where we could know much more and could have healthy relationships which are both respectful and scientifically valid, but we don't. Instead, there are sort of loggerhead situations. I think it's beginning to be fixed, but it's going to take some proper, you know, some proper engagement, some proper trying to understand people who were there before you, and in a non-patronizing way, in a way which doesn't say, yeah, we respect your traditions, but we do know more than you.
Yeah.
Because that is the history of sort of colonization, and you know, I'm a Brit. We are the worst colonizers of all. So.
Yeah. Yeah. You win the prize.
Yeah.
Well, so how do you? I wonder if you can apply that desire to be sensitive to culture and, you know, creation myths. In this sense, here in Utah, members of the Mormon Church have another version of how the American continent was peopled. They believe that a Jewish family left Jerusalem around 600 BC and made its way to America, and that the Native Americans today are partially descended from that branch of that family. What do you say to that one? What do you say to that spin on the story?
Well, in a certain way, it's kind of the same answer. I think that the durability, the length of time that a myth, a creation myth in this case, exists, isn't necessarily relevant to how we regard it.
Yeah.
What are there, like 14 million Mormons in America? Yeah. Is it something like that?
Well, worldwide, there's like 15, 16.
Okay,
million.
So but it's a lot, right?
Yeah.
You know,
it's a
significant proportion of people. We're not talking about a weird cult here. We're talking about the sincere beliefs of millions of people. Now, whatever you think about the truth of those those stories, those narratives, they are important to those people. And it, I mean, this may sound incredibly wishy-washy, and many of my colleagues disagree with me about this, but I think you get richer information if you are respectful to people than if you are either patronizing or you mock them. So it doesn't mean you have to accede to them. It doesn't mean you have to accept them. Yeah. But I think that, you know, listening to people is it's a very fruitful business. And I think maybe we don't do it enough.
I want to talk about the section you have on race. You begin it with your first encounter with racism. This was, I think it was 1981. You're at a supermarket with your sister. Talk a little bit about this, because it seems like I'm wondering what this taught you about how you're thinking about race.
Yeah, it's a funny thing that. I mean, it's kind of a funny story. I was 6 at the time. My sister's 18 months older than me. And so our mother was Indian, although actually never been to India, born in Guyana in South America. So, you know, there's a sort of colonial history within my own family, but I don't identify as anything other than British. But we lived in a village in relatively rural England. And some local kids saw us waiting outside the supermarket. And 1981, for listeners of a certain age, will remember the TV program The Kids from Fame.
Yeah.
And we were watching this program at the time. It was a big hit in the UK. And the two lead characters were Coco and Leroy, who were these incredibly charismatic African-American dancers. And me and my sister adored them. She was a good dancer. She did, you know, ballet for many years. I never really achieved anything other than rhythmic swaying. But nevertheless, these kids called us Coco and Leroy,
yeah.
Right? And we thought that was supremely cool. And that, you know, they had identified us by our skin color as being associated with these really, really awesome dancers on this TV program from faraway New York. And we thought that was great. My dad, who's is a committed anti-racist, marched against, you know, the with the anti-Nazi League. His best friend was a sort of cause celebre in the UK because he was actually murdered by a policeman during an anti-Nazi rally in the 70s. My dad, when he heard these kids say this to us, he went absolutely nuts in a way that actually was more scary than how these kids were talking to us, because we had no idea what was going on. We thought it was quite cool, but my dad was incensed, you know, furious. And that was it was very informative in the sense that, you know, we are being separated away from the rest of the kids in this village in a way that we didn't quite understand, but the passions that flared up in my own family members was something that we'd never seen before. Now, in the book, I'm a scientist, right? I'm not a sociologist. The book is not political in any way. I'm not making judgments. I'm just talking about the scientific stories. But there comes a point where you sort of can't do that when you talk about genetics and you talk about how people are, because race and genetics and the history of racism and the eugenics and all of these, you know, particularly unpleasant chapters in modern human history are all very, very tightly interwoven. And indeed, in my own academic story, because I was at UCL, I still have a position at UCL, at University in London, which in many ways was the sort of birthplace of the eugenics movement, but as a result of a scientist called Francis Galton, who was a genius scientist, invented many of the statistical techniques that we use to this day, drew the first weather map, effectively invented the science of fingerprinting, which we still use today. But he was also a massive, massive racist. Yeah. He was obsessed with his own genius and the genius of the white people, white men, because he wasn't interested in women at all. And many of the reasons he invented all of these statistical techniques and these ways of measuring people was in order to classify humans in a hierarchy, which, right, surprise, surprise, put white British London men at the top, yep, closely followed by the Chinese. And down at the bottom end, you have the Hindu, to use the words of the language of his time, mm-hmm, that he wrote, the Hindu, the Arab, and the Negro. Yeah. And yeah, so he kind of invented this science in order to reinforce these Victorian ideas of colonialization and race and human hierarchy. The thing that, you know, spoiler alert, and concluding that long chapter, the beauty of science is that genetics has shown that those classifiers do not work.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned earlier, that race is not an idea which holds much water in genetics. And so we're going through this peculiar historical time where people seem to be more interested in their own identities and biological identities and biological destiny and some of the things we've been talking about. And I think it's important that now more than ever we are talking about these sort of historical figures and their role in the way we think about ourselves and their role in science. One of my colleagues, who's the curator of the Galton Collection, says he's one old white dude that we should be talking more about.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, to that end, I think if you'd consider it, Adam Rutherford, I'd like to have you back at some point and just really work through this section, because there's so many different ideas in it. Let me mention one. It's the question of what the discovery of DNA has meant to this story and the conversation about race, because you point out that when Crick and Watson revealed the makeup of DNA, they also, and this is how you put it, biologized difference. Gave us an understanding of why people look different from each other. And I'm just wondering, has that meant a kind of conflict in the way we think about difference? Like, is there a conflict between science and our sort of social and cultural ideas about race?
Yes, I think that it has. So it's naive to pretend that we're all blank slates and that people are not different from each other, and that also broadly, people's differences on average can be measured across land masses. It's intellectually dishonest to not regard physical and visible traits as being different. So
right.
Some people have darker skin than others. Some people have different shaped eyes than others. Some people have different hair textures than others. Now, obviously, I'm referring to people of African descent there, and people of East Asian descent there, and there are other qualifiers. The thing is that the genetics that underlie those characteristics represent a very, very minuscule proportion of the total amount of genetic differences between people. And so we use them as visual cues and say, well, that guy's got black skin, or that woman has an epicanthic fold, which is the bit of skin that gives East Asian people that characteristic eye shape.
Mm.
And with that, if you then don't give it much thought, you say, well, all people with dark skin are of recent African descent, and therefore they are one race, and we call them, you know, Africans or African Americans if they're in America, or blacks, or, you know, whatever. Or if your mindset is politically different, you can use racial epithets,
right,
insults at this point. Now, the problem is, well, there's two problems within that. The first is that there are a huge range of skin pigmentations, almost continuous range of skin pigmentations. And whilst, yes, on average, people within the billion people within Africa on average have darker skin tones than the billion people in China, there is an enormous range within those populations of skin tone. So skin tone is not a really good, a useful qualifier for grouping people together. But the second reason is that it's even less useful as a qualifier because of the very, very small amount of genes, the few genes which are involved in that pigmentation process. Yeah, yeah. And we have 20,000 genes or so. We have 3 billion letters of genetic code. The variance within those 20,000 genes and within that whole 3 billion letters of our entire genome is much greater for within populations than for things like skin color or eye fold shape or those characterizers that people have generally and historically used. So the argument I'm making is basically the way we talk about race, I'm not excluding myself from this, the way it's useful for us to have to be able to group people together. But the way we talk about race is not reflected by the genetic diversity that underwrites people and human diversity. Mm. So, you know, in America, you could talk about African Americans, and that's one group of people who have darker skin, have more recent African origins than either you or I, right? You can group them together as a sort of social group like that, but what you can't really do is group them together as a biological group, because they have come from a huge part of America over many hundreds of years, and from different parts of Africa, which may mean that they're genetically more distinct from each other than either of them are to European settlers, or you or I. And, you know, that's what the genetics says. And so it's that very first point that you were asking me about again, that the cultural and social identifiers that people use are important and should not and cannot be denied. What you can't do is use science and biological destiny or DNA to reinforce them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I said about how everyone wants to discover that they're a Viking. Well, good for you. It's kind of meaningless.
Yeah.
But there are white supremacists out there who are trying to use DNA to show that they are biologically different from non-white Europeans and non-white humans, and therefore that gives them using that perceived biological difference as some sort of superiority. Now that is, well, you know, it's pernicious and it's fallacious. It's wrong and it's bad. And so this is a modern phenomenon. This is something that is only really, it's a modern twist on an older phenomenon, I should say, because DNA is now being used for this purpose, but it has of course been the same throughout the 20th century, using different markers. It's just that now that DNA is available to everyone for not that much money, it has emerged again as, you know, a way of people with political motivations for highlighting the differences between them and us, and that's a problem. Mm. You know, we need to think hard about how we talk about genetics, because misunderstanding this stuff is how conflict is sparked. Yeah, cry. That's a bit of a downer, isn't it?
Well, let me see if I can twist it. Finally, but you say that writing the book has affected the way you think about people. Let me ask you that finally. In what way?
Yeah, it did. I was. It's a little epilogue I put at the end, right? Yeah. Just when I was finishing, and I was close to my deadline, and I was writing on the bus on the way to work and on the underground. And I live in London, which is an incredibly diverse city anyway, and I'm of mixed ethnicity. And so I'd written all these things about the differences between people, and I talked about skin color and talked about some things that we can tell that are different about people but aren't necessarily visible. For example, people of East Asian descent, the backs of their incisors, their teeth, their front teeth, have on average a slightly different shape to them. I've never felt the back of an East Asian's incisor, as I expect many people haven't. But I was struck by, you know, sitting on the underground on a really busy Wednesday morning in March, where everyone's pretty rushed and not being that pleasant to each other. And I just kind of looked up and saw all these people and thought, isn't that amazing that we know stuff about your journey from 100,000 years ago to the underground in Brixton, near where I live. And we know that because of doing good genetics, because of doing good science and good archaeology. And it made me feel fluffy and warm. I said a minute ago that, it's not a political book. But I think sometimes scientists shy away from, we say the data's pure, science isn't political. Well, science is done by people, and this branch of science is about people. And as long as science is done by people and is about people, then it is going to be political, and we can't move away from that. And I think scientists, geneticists, can be more honest about the fact that people's politics affects the research questions that they ask, and it affects the way they interact with their subjects or the people that they're researching, and that includes, particularly indigenous populations if they're interested in those sorts of questions. And so I think we're doing really well. This is a really live bit of science. It's really exciting. We know more than ever before, and we're making progress at hand over fist. It's great. But I definitely think we can do better. And that's I'm an optimist about these things. I think we can know more by being better scientists and better people. So yeah, I said it was a downer a minute ago. Well, now I'm being all sort of super optimistic.
That's Adam Rutherford. His book is A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, The Human Story Retold Through Our Genes. He joined us from the studios of the BBC in London. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.